I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. One of the great collections this year has been the latest from Stephen Osborne, The Coincidence Problem, Selected Dispatches 1999 to 2022. In the book, he's collected a variety of essays and pieces from the last quarter century that reflect what's been on his mind. He's by no means an expert on coincidence, but throughout the collection are essays that look at how coincidence touches on a variety of issues, world politics, the changing city, and family history, among many others. There are forays into history, like the lynching of Indigenous youth Louis Sam, as well as the death of C.F. Keiss, who was struck down and killed by the first ambulance in the city of Vancouver in 1909. We get marvelous insight into what interests Mr. Osborne, who joins me now, and how his interesting and interested mind works. We'll talk about photographs, memory, and the collective memory of a city, and the future of where we live. The founder of Arsenal Pulp Press, who publishes this new collection, and co-founder of Geist Magazine, Stephen Osborne, is an award-winning writer. Among his many awards include the CBC Literary Award, the Vancouver Arts Award for Writing and Publishing, the National Magazine Foundation Special Achievement Award, and the Event Creative Nonfiction Prize. We spoke last week. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Stephen Osborne. Mr. Osborne, good morning.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us. You open this collection with a quote from D.M. Fraser in the epigraph. He died, what, about 40 years ago now? Almost 40 years ago?
1985.
Yeah. We're coming up to 40 years. So for a lot of people, like I wasn't particularly familiar with him or his work. What did he mean to you?
Well, he meant everything in early literary life. He was especially gifted. His prose technique was fantastic. But he wrote very little. He became an inspiration for a small group of writers locally and across the country. He was a regular at our office, at our early Pulp Press offices.
Mm-hmm.
He'd be there every day, typing away in the corner on the Remington, the old stand-up Remington. He was kind of like the muse in a way. To be around him made you want to be a writer, if you put it that way.
Hey, you mentioned where he lived, I think, in the collection. And so I did the thing, which is another thing we'll talk about in the course of our chat, about photographs. I went on Google Maps to look it up because I wasn't particularly familiar where it was or which side of Main Street it was. I guess it was Main, north of King Edward, where he lived?
Yes, no, it was south of a couple of blocks. He was at 28th and Main.
Mm.
Morris' Junk Store.
Yeah.
Still there.
When you look back at those days, you were all young and aspiring writers and people in the arts and the sort. Could you imagine for yourself, Stephen, where you are today?
Oh, no, there was no sense of the future. You could say in the 70s that sensibility was living the moment, which has caused all kinds of pitfalls. But the thing I think that was most important at that period was the decrepit state of the city. You know, most of the tall office buildings that exist now weren't there. There was a previous generation of buildings that were in bad shape. And the downtown was starting to change, and the result was low rents. You could get yourself an office for very little money and get started doing something. So you had us, Pulp Press. You had Talon Books, a few blocks east, Press Gang, the feminist printers and publishers, McCara Magazine. These are all made possible by the low economic state of the city. So as the city grew up and became Expo 86,
mm-hmm.
Everything changed. It became more and more difficult to stay in business. And so I think that the major element of that period of the 70s, which is a fruitful period, was in fact property values, the lack of them.
Well, what do you think changes in a city as a result of all that? in terms of the arts and the arts community, the letters community, if you will, the writing community. Do you think a lot's been lost because of all that in the last 35, 40 years, say?
Well, it'd be hard to say that something's been lost, because I wouldn't have evidence of that. But certainly, the economic system, the economic situation today, makes it almost impossible to start up a cultural enterprise on your own. Where are you going to find the low rent, the low overhead? So the one result is that larger groups have to work together. We may end up with a literary arts center over there on Lower Main Street,
mm-hmm.
eventually, but it's been years in discussion. I don't know. My sense of things being lost is quite real, but it tends to be the geography. You can walk down the downtown now, but you may as well walk downtown in any other city. It would be pretty much the same. There was glass and steel walls, glass and aluminum. I get sentimental if I think that there was something special in the 70s. The fact of the 70s was that people were able to walk to each other's businesses. Now you've got to go to outlying areas.
Yeah.
That's all I can say about that.
Yeah. You mentioned something a moment ago that reminded me of a line in an essay that's in the book. It's from Unfinished Business, which is a catalog from a museum exhibit about 20 years ago. The opening essay in that catalog, which is in this collection, The Coincidence Problem, where one can get sentimental about a place even if they've never been there. And I actually have a copy of Unfinished Business, and I've been looking through it the last couple of days. And I was born in 1982, so a lot of those photographs in that collection were from before I was even born.
Uh-huh.
And yet, I did feel that twinge of sentimentality.
Yeah.
It's of a Vancouver that I know, that I'm familiar with, if you will, but that's obviously gone now. That's something you talk about in the book, about photographs, it's fascinating to look at what photography means for a lot of people.
Oh, yes, I think it's still a great mystery. I'm always tempted to turn a photograph over just to see if the backside can be seen, if what's being hidden in the photo
yeah.
can be seen.
Yeah.
I've actually carried out an experiment when I was a kid trying to do that. I had a little darkroom and I could make prints. And I conceived, I can't even remember how I did it, because of course it was a failure, but a way of trying to expose the negative onto its backside so that we could see what was behind what was in the picture. And I had to prove to myself that it didn't hold up, which just leaves me with more of a mystery. What is this dimensionless piece of paper? How can it have such power? And when you talk about the 70s being a field of nostalgia for yourself, I think of the 1920s. Being a field of nostalgia for me. Of course, I was born in 1947, so it's a long ways away to the 20s, but I just have to look at those photographs and see and feel a desire. The nostalgia raises up in me.
I mentioned Google Maps a moment ago. It's fun, this phenomenon of Google Maps. I don't know how long it's been now. We've had it in our lives about 10 years or more. You can scroll over using your mouse, looking to what's left or what's right of whatever you're looking at. And sometimes I find myself, when I see an old photograph online, trying to do the same.
Yeah, of course.
But you can't.
Yeah. Very frustrating and tempting. It pulls you into it.
Yeah, then you do feel regret that, they never took a photo of what was to the left or to the right,
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Did you take a lot of photographs yourself?
Yeah, I've been a photographer in an amateur way for many years, since I was a kid.
And did you actually, we all have cell phones now. Did you use your cell phone to take pictures? Or?
No, that's where my photography started to slow down. I never adapted to the cell phone. So I still don't really know how to use it properly. And so where I see, though, the results of photography everywhere are looking pretty good with cell phones. I just haven't taken the time to learn it yet.
Yeah, but we're talking on Monday afternoon. I was out and about on Saturday and Sunday around, you know, 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and the sun looked really nice out. And the way it hit certain buildings and trees here in Vancouver, I was Fraser and King Edward on Saturday. On Sunday, I was elsewhere in the city. I can't remember where I was now. I was so tempted to take my phone out and take a photo. But, again, I'm not very good at it. And I knew that I wouldn't be able to capture with my photo what I was looking at. And so all I have now is just to satisfy myself with a memory of it, I guess.
Well, I prefer that myself in light of sunset photographs, cloud photographs, tree photographs. These tend to be kind of tokens of one's attention and not anything to do with the thing itself. So it proves that you are there, which is good. That's what photography does, but it doesn't tell anything else. And I've always avoided sunset pictures, but I have to confess, not completely.
Yeah. What do you think this says about how our memory works? You know, as we get older, we tend to lose a lot of our memory. We think we do.
I think about this a lot.
Yeah.
Because I use questions around memory as try to as a impetus when I'm writing. The thing that I feel about memory is that there's much less of it there than we think there is. When you, let's say, pause and consider a memory of something that happened or somewhere you were, there'll only be a few details, a handful of details, that come to mind. My recommendation to myself and to young writers has always been try to stick only with those things, those few things that come back to you. It's as if memory is a flat field and there's occasional protuberances sticking up, little volcano-like elements, but just a few. Those are the things you actually remember, and those are the things you should write. Try to get from one to the next without inventing new details. And a good exercise in paying attention to what's in front of you, being the sentence that's in front of you. And the thing that's related to that is dreams.
Mm.
When you try to recall a dream again, it's like memory. The kind of memory, you again usually only have a few details, and they're always fleeting. They tend to be stopping and starting and covering each other up, but there's just a handful, and if you can stay with those tiny handful, you might be able to write the dream. Trying to write down dreams, I think, is the hardest thing about writing.
Yeah, you know, I never really thought about that, but the other thing I'm thinking about is I don't get enough sleep, so I never get to that point where I get to dream. And so I think I really think I'm missing out on a lot.
Well, just last week I bought myself an eye mask.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was having trouble sleeping. It made a hell of a difference starting just the first night.
Really?
I recommend it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about that, yeah.
Strap that baby on there, you'll go into dreamland.
The other thing that you just mentioned that triggered something for me, like, I've been at events that have been photographed and videotaped, and I have to say I've tended to rely on those things because I figure, you know, I can go back to the videotape or go back to the photograph later and remember it, and then I find out years later I've forgotten that I was actually at a certain event. And then it's those places or those events that I've been to where there hasn't been a recording, say, that I tend to remember the most.
Yes, I've had the same experience. In fact, I stopped using the camera as an aid to memoir.
And
I realized that was happening. I take a photograph and forget it.
Yeah.
Forget the thing. So I don't do that now. I just write things down, make notes in a notebook. And I can retain it better.
Yeah, that's a good way of going about life, I think, in general. So we've talked about the city and how you've reflected on it through your writing, and we see that throughout this collection. Do you have an idea, Stephen, about where we're headed as a city, say?
It looks bleak, and it just gets so expensive.
Yeah.
I don't see, nobody can even start to pay the rent, let alone think about ever buying an apartment. At least nobody I know. So I try not to think about it. I cross my fingers and hope for the best for my grandchildren, for instance. I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah, I think crossing one's fingers and hoping for the best, I think, is the only thing we can do, I think, in unfortunate times. And I think that that's, I have to say, that's a feeling that a lot of people feel, wherever they are in the city. And you got to go through it. I guess you get to the end of the day and then hope to get to the next one, I suppose.
Try not to be too bleak.
Yeah. talking about expensive, there are a few essays that talk about certain restaurants that you've frequented over the years. And I actually, as I was reading the book, you know, took note of some of these names and then went to Google and found out that a lot of them are no longer around. What do you look for in a place to eat?
Well, first of all, that it's not too noisy.
Mm.
That's the problem with Vancouver restaurants, and the same in other cities. There's too many smooth surfaces, too many glass or varnished. So it takes three or four people in a room like that to fill the whole place with noise. I find that's the worst element in restaurants in Vancouver, and so finding noise-free ones is enough to make me go back. My favorite restaurant was the Kathmandu on Commercial Drive.
Mm.
And I got to know it very well. It was a beautiful interior. And the proprietor, a guy named Abby, ran a beautiful restaurant. And after the earthquake in Nepal, he had to rescue his mother financially and eventually moved back there. And the restaurant closed, which was a big loss. I don't have any favorite restaurants at the present time. I think I lost them. A lot of people lost their restaurants during the COVID.
Yeah.
We lost the habit of going.
I find myself going to Burnaby now more often than not. Just for the variety of things to, you know, the variety of things to eat, whether you're on Kingsway or Hastings, especially. It could be, you know, the how exorbitant rents are in Vancouver that one is forced to eat outside of their own city more often.
Well, I think that's true enough that you can do it. It's my case, I don't drive until I have to be limited to buses and reasonable distances for taxis.
Yeah.
But New Westminster has some interesting places in it, too.
Yeah.
A bit of a history left there.
That's true, too, yeah. Yeah, it's nice to walk through, say, in and around, say, Columbia, just outside of the station. Say, you mentioned not driving. Have you always not driven?
No, I've only ever owned a car once in my life for a brief period of a few months. An old Volkswagen that a friend of mine lost in the fog. I lent it to him to pick up some stuff, and he parked it. Ran into it to make a little delivery, and the car was gone when it came out, and was never seen again.
Yeah.
So that was a Volkswagen, which cost me $50.
Actually, there is an essay in the book where you talk about driving a friend's car.
Of course.
So I forgot about that. The reason why I asked that is because when you mentioned not driving, I just thought that I found another kindred spirit in that, because I'm 42 and I've never driven ever.
Oh, good for you.
And
D.M. Fraser could drive, but he drove so badly that he never drove. And a few other people at Paul Press in the early years were voluntary non-drivers.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought of them as a kind of aristocratic group.
I live, you know where I live, and I just anywhere I needed to go, I never had to drive, right?
Yeah.
Because of the bus or as you mentioned a moment ago, taxis. It's just something I've never felt I've needed to take up. And now at 42, I think I'm too old to learn how to drive.
You are, yes. Forget it. Don't bother.
Yeah. there's a review of your book that made mention of how you seem to know so much and wondered if you research your writing that perhaps it took hours to research, say it. And I don't know, that struck with me over the years because I don't know how you felt about it, but I felt it a little, when I read that, I thought that was, I guess the reviewer was reading too much into what you've written maybe and the sort. But I mean, when you do write in, especially this essay about this guy, Mr. C.F. Keiss, is that how you pronounce his name, or Keiss?
I pronounce it Keiss, but I don't know. I've never heard it spoken before.
Yeah.
I know the story you mean.
Yeah, and so, I mean, you know, there's a hell of a lot of information in that. And I remember reading that as a kid in a Chuck Davis book, you know, one line, that the city's first ambulance was taken out for a test drive and kills a man. So you do a wonderful thing in this essay that's in this collection, piece together what he was doing in the city, how he got to the city, and what happened to him afterwards, after this incident, and what happened to his body, I should say. Is that an essay where there was a lot of research, say, involved?
Well, actually, there's quite a bit of so-called research in pretty well all of the stuff that's in the book. But I don't ever think of it as research, and sometimes it takes a long time for it to come into a narrative form, but for instance, Mr. Keiss, when I read that line in an interview that the city archivist made in 1931, he interviewed a woman named Mrs. Ben Alley, I think it is, who recalled for him having raised money to fund the new ambulance, which was revolutionary in 1907 or 1909, and that she helped fundraise. And then she said in passing, oh yes, and the funniest thing, the ambulance on its maiden, a motor ambulance installed on its maiden drive through the city, ran over an American tourist and killed him. And turned the, so that the ambulance became a hearse.
Yeah.
And it struck me as not only slightly ludicrous, but very strange. And in the context of a conversation with the archivist, it was mainly about family picnics. He was remembering her childhood of the going picnics here and there, going fishing in Crow's Lake. There's a mundane daily life. And then she throws in this line about the American tourist. So I went, that time I had to go to the library to read microfilm.
Mm-hmm.
I went to get the newspapers of the day, and I found the story. And then I saw the guy was from a place called Bucyrus, Ohio. But Bucyrus is the name of this huge excavation machine they use in Alberta tar sands. So that was a little connection. And then I found myself simply following, it felt more like following breadcrumbs. They were on an expedition to the, they got licenses to go on an expedition to Powell River to hunt, he and two friends. And then, so I looked up the hunting licenses from 1909. And they entitled you to, on any, you know, 5 caribou, 10 deer, 2 bull moose, 5 mountain goats, no more than 250 ducks.
Mm-hmm.
Once I had that kind of information, I felt like I was getting a little trail. It was leading me somewhere. I didn't know where, except that there was a part of it that was leading to Mr. Keiss and the ambulance. So then I looked into the ambulance and found a catalog for the Cunningham Motor Company online for that year. And their new model, ambulance was for sale, first combustion engine ambulance. So that was another little thing. And I looked up where they were. They were from Rochester, or they might be from Rochester. I've forgotten which is which, but they were out there in the eastern states.
Mm-hmm.
The train that would have brought the car, the ambulance, all the way to the Pacific Coast would have carried Mr. Keiss as well.
Yeah.
So that, and in fact, I was tempted to just force it into a literary coincidence and make them come on the same train. They didn't. They came on separate trains. But the ambulance was one train, and the other one was carrying Mr. Pace and his two pals. And they went to Seattle, where there was a big exposition on, and eventually got up to Vancouver to do their hunting. And that day that they got into Vancouver, the ambulance in Vancouver was going on its test drive. It hit him in the intersection of Pender and Granville. And so that it was too cute in a way.
Yeah.
If I had put them on the same train, I would have been doing damage to the reality of the story. And so I went with fact, which was a little harder to write. But it was accumulating detail. What tourist guide did they have with them? And what did they say in the tourist guide about Vancouver? So I quoted that stuff to give a flavor of what that past was like. So I think of writing this kind of narrative, what they call them dispatches often, is more of an accumulation of tiny detail than I developing a plot. So there's no diagram, no beginning or ending, in fact. The question that's raised is, what is the nature of an event? Now, an event certainly was the hitting of the ambulance hitting the guy. But there's the event of the guy hitting the town. There's many events, and we don't know where they start and where they end, but they seem to emerge into the world from each other. So that's a long way of saying.
No, and
accumulate the details.
Yeah, if I was to rewrite that review, I would say that it's not a question of what Mr. Osborne knows. But it's the way his mind works to accumulate that knowledge that's the fascinating. It's just as you've illustrated, the way your mind works is just, in not just in this piece, but in a number of pieces in this collection, that's borne out just how fascinating your mind works and how relatable it might be for a lot of people in terms of how they, say, find out something and then that leads them down this path to find out more about something else. And
it's going down the path. That's the first step.
Yeah,
I know what you're talking about in a way. I have many times just gone out into the onto the sidewalk and started walking. And there's a way that one kind of prepares oneself for a coincidence, so to say, or for a juxtaposition. And if you're waiting, ready for it, it'll be there. But you can't be conscious. It's a funny thing. You get to the state where you're not conscious of anything particular. You're just walking along. And then something will emerge. So I went out looking for, we were looking for a new office for a publishing company, at Pulp Press, in about 1978. And I announced to the people in the office I was going to go out and find a new office, just as a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I went down the fire escape and into the alley and past the Marble Arch beer parlor and down B Street and around the corner. And when I got there, I looked up and I'd forgotten that I had any mission by then. I looked up, and there was a sign on the side of one of those big warehouses. It said, Osborne Mattress Company. So there was a sign, and I could say to myself, there's a sign. And so I took out this sign and walked toward it.
Yeah.
And it was attached to a warehouse, an empty warehouse, and in the doorway was the landlord. I introduced myself to him, and by an hour later, I'd signed the lease. He had his whole floor open for $300 a month. It was fabulous. That kind of reward is, you can't force it. You can't make it happen. But it comes about because of a willingness to let things happen.
Yeah. That's the fabulous thing about this collection is that there are moments like this, you're not, obviously, a coincidence expert, but you've been attuned to seeing them. Wherever they might be. And I don't know, you mentioned something that I found fascinating, or found interesting to say the least. You know how somebody will bring up something in conversation and say, that's only a coincidence. You don't like that, do you? And I don't like that either, because I don't think that explains anything at all, does it?
No, it doesn't help anything. But it is true that the coincidence is kind of pushed off to the side. That event is only a coincidence, therefore I don't have to consider it. it's a way of dismissing the world. Whereas a person, a more naive person, is, oh, that's a wonderful, that's wonderful, that's a coincidence. And the world gets a little bit brighter for them. But the refusal for a coincidence is a kind of mark of a mature adult. The school teacher who takes no nonsense.
Yeah. Some people might think that's divine intervention, no coincidence, or fate even. You don't fall in that category either, do you?
Well, what I do get is because of the strong emotion that sometimes accompanies these things of surprise and delight, is that it's an opportunity to glimpse the underlying interconnectedness of the world.
Mm.
The thing that we don't feel often is suddenly stated for us. And the sensation to me is that I feel slightly embarrassed. I feel slightly unconscious, self-conscious in the face of a coincidence. For instance, I talked about seeing a friend at the end of the block who I hadn't thought of for a long time, but I was thinking about him at that moment. And there he is standing at the other end of the block with his wife, and they're both waving at me. And I waved back, of course, because they were talking about me as I was thinking of him. Well, this made us all laugh.
Yeah.
We were talking about it. And that's all you do. And the feeling of certain shyness is, here's the universe looking at me, saying, what do you make of this? That's as far as it goes. It's a lovely thing to happen.
Yeah, that is a great thing to think about, that how interconnected we are, because we tend to forget that when especially nowadays, when we think we're all different from one another.
Yeah.
And there's a lot that divides us, say.
Exactly.
There is something underlying that connects us, and we mustn't lose sight of that. Stephen, I could talk to you all afternoon, but I'm going to let you go. This has been incredibly enjoyable to talk to you and to get to reflect on this collection, which I've enjoyed a great deal. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you kindly. It's a pleasure being on the show.
The book is called The Coincidence Problem, Selected Dispatches 1999 to 2022. It's published by Arsenal Pulp Press. Its author, Stephen Osborne, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.